Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, and at 13 hours GMT on the 14th of July, these are our main stories. The British government will exclude the Chinese firm Huawei from its 5G telecoms network, a policy change that will please Washington but anger Beijing. Tensions between India and Nepal increase, this time over a Hindu deity's birthplace. And California reimposes lockdown measures after a spike in coronavirus cases. Also in the podcast...
There are snakes and worms. Water gets cut off in the bathrooms. In the winter, rain leaks into where we live.
We hear from a 9-year-old girl, Ruha, a refugee from Syria, who's the same age as the war in her country. Is the Chinese tech giant Huawei a startup miracle selling affordable products, or is it a security risk operating under Beijing's control? Well, the British government has come up with a new answer to that. It will now completely exclude Huawei from building its future 5G data networks. The announcement came from the Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden.
In January, we set out to this House our conclusions on how we would define and restrict high-risk vendors, keeping them outside the network's core and away from critical infrastructure and sites. And Mr. Speaker, we have been clear-eyed from the start that Chinese-owned vendors, Huawei and ZTE, were deemed to be high risk.
The United States has already turned its back on Huawei, arguing we still don't know the truth about the company's murky ownership structure or how much financial aid it receives from the Chinese state, not to mention the level of control Beijing holds over data that passes through Huawei networks. So, is the security threat posed by Huawei proven or perceived? I asked the BBC's technology correspondent, Rory Catlin-Jones.
Well, I think it's probably a perceived one. Huawei's equipment has been across UK telecoms networks for nearly 20 years now. There has been suspicion about it. The intelligence agency GCHQ set up a whole unit to examine KIT, it still does, from Huawei and make sure that it didn't feature any backdoors. And in as recently as January, it said the risk was manageable. Back then, Huawei was limited to having 35% of any 5G network in the UK. But now the risk has got greater because of sanctions imposed by the US, threatened by the US, to limit Huawei's access to reliable US chip technology. And I think that is causing greater concern. So it's a perceived concern, and it's a concern about control, who's in charge of this company.
Why was Huawei equipment chosen in the first place? Technologically, is it really ahead of the competition?
Well, it's the world's leading equipment maker. It's poured a huge amount into research and development. Where that money's come from has been open to question. And it has provided equipment at a very competitive price. So it's been the natural choice for a lot of telecoms operators looking to save money. And it has generally been seen as ahead of the curve. So worth having and at a keen price.
So why has the UK government changed its stance? A question for our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Well, I guess big picture thing to say in the first place, Celia, is that UK policy, both economic and diplomatic towards China, is in disarray. But perhaps we'll come back to that in a minute. It's changed for two reasons. I mean, in the first place, the UK has found itself utterly caught in a row and a dispute between the two really big players here, the United States and China. And secondly, of course, the mood towards China has very much soured in the UK and particularly inside the governing Conservative Party, which, although the UK is desperate in this post-Brexit world to find new trading partners, many Conservative MPs were very, very unhappy about this relationship involving Huawei.
Rob, are all China-linked projects up for debate now in the UK? Of course, China is already helping to build a new nuclear plant.
I think absolutely everything will be under review. You're right, there is a plant called Hinkley Point now. A Chinese company called CGN. It's a minority stakeholder there. The biggest one is a French company, EDF. But that company, China, had been eyeing other nuclear reactor projects in the UK. Now, there have already been calls from senior Conservatives, including a former leader of the party, to say, well, look, all of this should be reviewed. I mean, this particular politician, he said, well, would China allow the UK to build a nuclear power station in its country? But again, I go back to that point, this sort of dilemma that the UK faced. Previous government, led by David Cameron and George Osborne, had talked about a golden era in relations with China where economics were prioritised over everything else in 2015. I mean, now to the extent that the UK has any form of strategy towards China, it is in disarray.
And do you think the UK will be rewarded by the US for making this decision?
That is a very difficult question to answer. I mean, certainly that the UK will hope so, but I think it's less that the UK is looking for a reward. It was rather more that it was in an absolutely impossible position, squeezed by its friends, if you like, its own MPs in the Conservative Party and by Washington. But I mean, the idea that the UK is going to emerge from this with any kind of reward seems unlikely. I mean, if you think about it, what is it all going to mean? It's going to mean that the rollout of high technology in the UK, the 5G network, is going to take 2 years longer, the minister said, and at an extra cost of over $2 billion.
Rob Watson. There's been no official response yet to the UK's decision from China, but in a separate development, Beijing's imposed sanctions on the US defense firm Lockheed Martin for its involvement in the latest US arms sale to Taiwan. The announcement comes just days after Beijing placed sanctions on senior U.S. politicians who criticized the country's treatment of ethnic and religious minorities in Xinjiang province. Zhao Lijian is a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry.
China firmly opposes U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. We urge the U.S. to earnestly abide by the One China principle and our three joint communiques. Stop selling arms to Taiwan and cut its military ties with it so that it won't do further damage to bilateral relations between China and the U.S. and the peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait.
Lockheed Martin is the main contractor under contention for a possible $620 million upgrade of Taiwan's missile defense system. Although Beijing regularly denounces such arms sales, these latest sanctions are another sign of increased diplomatic tensions between China and the United States, as our correspondent Stephen McDonnell explains.
In recent weeks, barely a day has gone by without Beijing and Washington attacking one another and announcing new rounds of recriminations. Spokesman Zhao Lijian also accused the United States of being a troublemaker and undermining peace in the region, after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo dismissed China's claims to offshore resources in most of the South China Sea as illegal.
Tensions between India and its neighbour Nepal have just gone up a level. This time, the focus is on a Hindu deity's birthplace. Hindus traditionally believe that Lord Ram was born in northern India. But now the Nepali Prime Minister says Lord Ram was born in his country. Our South Asia regional editor Ambarasan Etharajan told me more.
Have you heard of the term touched a raw nerve? This is exactly what it is, because by making this statement, the Nepali Prime Minister has triggered a storm in India. You know, after this news came out last evening, I was watching social media. On Twitter, many people didn't even put any word. They just put the emojis of shock or speechless. This is such an emotional issue between the two countries. Let's go to the background. India and Nepal both are Hindu majority nations, and they both believe in, you know, same gods and goddesses. And Lord Ram, as you said, was one of the important deity in the Hindu religion. And traditionally, for centuries, Hindus believed he was born in a place called Ayodhya in northern India. And for politically, if you look at it, the Hindu nationalist BJP has been campaigning to build a temple there for more than three decades. In fact, it was one of the important reasons why they came to power. Now, The Nepali Prime Minister, KP Sharma Oli, has now triggered a big controversy by saying, no, Lord Ram was born in Nepal and there has been a cultural encroachment. This is a direct attack on India and India's, you know, cultural background. So he is now triggering more controversy, what many people in India would see as a deliberate provocation and also, you know, coming at a time of souring ties between the two countries.
Are his comments receiving support in Nepal?
Many people in Nepal on social media said, no, this is quite unnecessary because he's not only taking on the Hindu nationalist BJP, even the rest of the Indian population, because religion is a very emotional issue back in India. And this has been a, you know, centuries-old belief. And while scoring points, he should not be doing this. You know, you have to look at the background, what happened in the last few years. You know, Mr. Oli belongs to the Nepal Communist Party. And under this communist rule, Nepal has moved away from the Indian sphere of influence and has gone towards its northern neighbor, China. China has like invested in millions of dollars. Now they are very chill within Nepal. And India views this with suspicion. And Mr. Oli also published the country's map recently, which included some of the disputed areas in the tri-junction between India, Nepal and China. And many in India believe that this would not have happened without China's backing. You know, the whole politics is being seen as how China is playing a role in Nepal. So we see the bigger game between India and China, and Nepal is playing a role here.
Ambarasa Natarajan. There's been outrage in Brazil after a video of a policeman stepping on the neck of a black woman was broadcast on television. The shocking footage has been compared to the death of the black American man, George Floyd, which led to worldwide protests against police brutality. My colleague, Lawrence Pollard, spoke to our correspondent in Brazil, Luiz Fajardo.
The incident apparently occurred in late May. However, over the weekend, a major national TV program showed the video. The video was captured by someone with his phone camera. It's in the city of Sao Paulo, Brazil's largest city. And you can see a police officer stepping on the neck of a 51-year-old black woman who's in the ground. Apparently, she had been involved in an altercation over apparently noise in a bar she owned. And the police officer appears is stepping on her neck and staying a few seconds in that situation. The lady said she was taken to the hospital afterwards with broken ribs.
I'm very struck about what the authorities have done to the police officers involved.
Yes, the governor of the state of Sao Paulo, João Doria, expressed a great deal of disgust over the situation. He said that it was a stain in the honor of the police. And the two police officers involved, both the person who was seen putting his foot on her neck, he was dismissed from the police force, and one of his colleagues as well, who was also involved in the operation.
Now, that's a very strict response and a very speedy response. Has the video elicited a kind of a wave of protest, either online or in the streets, along the lines of the George Floyd video?
Of course, a lot of people are making the comparison to the crisis around the George Floyd situation. However, I don't think the situation is you can compare it right now. There has been criticism in Brazilian media, but not the kind of overwhelming response that you saw, for example, in the U.S. over the Floyd incident. Of course, the whole issue of police violence in Brazil is a very, very controversial one. And it is also one with strong racial undertones. 75% of fatalities in police control, in police custody in Brazil are involving black people, or even though they are only 55% of the population. And police violence is a constant source of controversy and of criticism in Brazil. In 2018, more than 6,000 people were killed in police action. That was nearly 17 deaths a day. So it is clearly a big situation. Other people are saying that, unfortunately, the Brazilian society seems sometimes to react stronger to events that were occurring in the U.S., for example, the George Floyd incident, which created protests in Brazil even earlier than they would protest of a similar situation in their own country.
Now, you see, that is very interesting, and I suppose that's partly because of the manner that the public discussion about racism takes place in Brazil. I mean, I always get the impression that in Brazil, Brazilians like to see themselves as not a racist society, as almost a post-racial society. Do you think that helps explain that attitude?
That is certainly one attitude you find in Brazil. The official discourse, I guess, presents what they call a myth of racial democracy, a very mixed, multi-ethnic society. And that is true to a point. But it is clear that there are very, very, very strong racial injustices in Brazil.
Luiz Fajardo. For the past few years, we've been following the life of a Syrian refugee, Rua, who is the same age as her country's war, 9 years old. It's a conflict that's killed hundreds of thousands of people and created the world's largest refugee crisis. More than 13 million Syrians have had to flee their homes. More than 5 million of them are now living in neighboring countries. The UN says only a tiny fraction of those who need new homes ever get the chance to be resettled. But Rua and her family have defied the odds, as Caroline Hawley reports.
My name is Rua.
And you're going to England? These are the last few hours she has left with her best friend Ilham. Their lives are about to diverge so dramatically they might never see each other again.
I'm happy because I will study and be able to have a future, but I'm also a little bit sad.
I asked what she expected from England.
Clean toilets and a clean home. They say that over there I'll have a bed, that it's cold and there's good education.
Rua's family is well aware that this is a chance that comes to just a tiny fraction of Syrian refugees. They've barely slept for the past week. They've been so excited to leave the makeshift camp where they've lived since 2013.
There are snakes and worms. Water gets cut off in the bathrooms. In the winter, rain leaks into where we live.
The room we're in, it's about 12 feet by 10 feet. And for nearly 7 years, it's been the whole life of this family. It's where they've eaten, it's where they've slept. Rua, her mum, her dad, her brother, her sister. Imagine your life in one room. And now they're leaving it. It's a really bittersweet moment for the family. It's nearly time for them to leave, and relatives and neighbours have come to give them a last send-off to celebrate their escape. All, without exception, wished that they were going too. There's a whole tent full of suffering here. Some of the women have lost close relatives in Syria. There are mothers looking after children who need life-transforming surgery or with special needs. Everyone here wanted their voice, their desperation heard.
This woman's saying she just wishes they were going too. Pretty much all the women in here have got tears in their eyes.
Ali, Rua's nephew, screams for his grandmother as the family finally leave. After less than an hour's drive, they've already entered another world. None of them have ever been on a plane before. Already it feels like they've left the camp far behind.
Hello, I'm Trina. Are you Rua?
Yeah.
Hello.
Trina?
Trina.
Yes.
A day later, and they're inside their new home.
You like the house?
Very good.
Yeah.
House, very good. Very
yeah.
good.
Yeah, you like?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good, I'm just glad you're safe.
Hello.
The first thing they want to do is to call Lamia and, using my iPhone, show her around. They open their new cupboards, show her their beds, their light switches, and, of course, the bathroom. There's hot water day and night, Rua's mother says. They've had plenty of time in lockdown to enjoy the comforts of their new home, to eat meals around a table, to think of the extraordinary journey they've made from surviving a chemical attack in Syria to Lebanon to Essex. I've been asked not to say exactly where they are. The local council wants to give them the best chance of settling in. And there has been some hostility here towards immigrants. But it's near the sea and they've never been on a beach before. Rua's little brother says he feels happy and safe. She's disappointed not to have been able to start school yet, but she too says she's very happy. Her verdict on England so far?
It's very nice. I want coronavirus to end, my sister Lamia to come here, and I want to go to school as soon as possible.
Rua, ending that report by Caroline Hawley. Still to come in this podcast... very different national day for France, the traditional military parade gives way to a ceremony honoring health workers. Now to California, where a surge in COVID-19 cases has prompted the governor, Gavin Newsom, to reimpose lockdown measures across the state. There's been a 20% rise in Californians testing positive in the past 2 weeks.
Here in the state of California, as we're seeing triple-digit weather in many parts of our state, we're still seeing an increase in the positivity rate, the community transmission. We're seeing an increase in the spread of the virus. So that's why it's incumbent upon all of us to recognize soberly that COVID-19 is not going away anytime soon until there is a vaccine and or an effective therapy.
The governor ordered all indoor businesses across the state to close immediately. Bars, restaurants, movie theaters, and museums will shut their doors. It's a huge setback for small business owners in California already suffering from the first lockdown. This woman, who runs a hair salon in Contra Costa County, was frustrated by the announcement.
I, as a business owner, cannot tell someone, you can't work to put food on the table. You can't work to take care of your kids. I'm not going to do it this time. I stood up, and I stood up tall to say, we cannot work any longer. When we got notice before, I obeyed. And this time I can't say that that's going to be my choice. It's their choice.
Just months ago, California was being touted as a COVID miracle for managing to keep numbers low despite its high-density cities and its renowned connections with Asia and Europe. So what went wrong? Dr. Robert Wachter runs the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
It was appropriate to begin easing the restrictions. We were doing so well and things seemed under control. And so the restrictions were eased, but I think people took that as the starting gun for changing the behavior too much. And I think too many people got a little bit complacent. And as you know, in the United States, the messaging on things like masks has been quite muddied, in part because the federal government has been very unclear, if sometimes unhelpful. And so it was not inappropriate for us to begin opening up, but we had to do it the right way.
When Iran eased coronavirus lockdown restrictions in early June, the number of COVID-19 cases began to increase. Now, more than a month later, the authorities have reimposed lockdown measures for 1 week. I got the details from the BBC Persian's Rana Rahimpour.
Restrictions are announced in at least 10 provinces because the authorities say that the situation is very alarming. It's important to remember that Iran started facing the pandemic in February, a few weeks before Europe. But it went down during March as a result of New Year holiday and restrictions that were put in place by the government, and that they were slowly removed. But more importantly, very similar to many young people in California, the Iranian youth are not following the procedures that the government has asked them to. Many of them are not wearing face masks. And a deputy health minister said that there are many weddings and family gatherings, and that's one of the main reasons why the virus is spreading so fast.
And so do you think now that these more wide-ranging lockdown restrictions are being put into place, are people going to pay attention to what the government's saying? Are they going to follow the orders?
Well, if the schools and universities are closed, the restaurants and cafes are closed, they don't have many places to hang out in. But the question is whether 1 week is enough. And one thing that is important to remember is that Iran is suffering from U.S. sanctions. The economy is in a very dire situation. The government can't possibly feed the people, give them put them on furlough. They cannot hold on to these restrictions for more than a week. So it'll be difficult. Even if the people follow the procedures, they will have to open businesses. And this is just a short-term measure, which many people doubt it will have any effects whatsoever.
Rana Rahimpour. The trial of the former head of the Islamic Police in the city of Timbuktu has begun at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Ulhassan Ag Abdulaziz is accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity that allegedly took place during the conflict in Mali nearly a decade ago. Many girls and women were allegedly forced to marry Islamist militants who controlled the city. The presiding judge, Antoine Kachembe Mendua, read out the charges.
Monsieur Alhassan aurait exercé.
Mr. Alhassan would have exercised daily functions and powers within the Islamic police and within the organization, and they would have contributed to the activities of the Timbuktu operation at least from May the 7th, 2012, until January 28th, 2013. Mr. Alhassan would be criminally responsible for the crimes referred to.
Our correspondent Ishaq Khalid gave more details about the charges.
The case stems from the destruction of mausoleums and war crimes allegedly committed in Timbuktu between 2012 and 2013, when the ancient city fell in the hands of militants who administered their version of Islamic law or the Sharia law. At that time, they occupied the city, they destroyed mausoleums and other important historic cultural sites and mosques as well.
Ishaq Khalid. Egypt has begun reopening many of its ancient sites that were closed because of the coronavirus pandemic, places like the famous Great Pyramid of Giza. But without international visitors thronging to see these ancient sites, tourism remains in tatters. And that's having a devastating effect on a country that relies on showing off its historic treasures. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports.
An historic cleanup at the Great Pyramids in Giza. Workers spray the stones with disinfectant. For millennia, this world wonder has wowed visitors. But coronavirus killed off Egypt's tourism, and with it, the livelihoods of millions. Like the camel owners. With no tourists taking rides or posing for photos, some had to sell their animals just to feed their families. Corona's affected me deeply, Hamdi says. There's no work. My camel needs $5 a day for food. How can I afford that and the money for my kids to go to nursery and have nappies? This was last year, bustling with tourists. The dramatic downturn in the economy comes after Egypt's best year in a decade. The ancient attractions are now reopening, but they're empty.
You should come to Egypt. Yes, come on here, yes. Baby.
On social media, guide Shahenda Adel shares her happy memories, showing American tourists the history of the country she loves. In the past few weeks, she lost 1,000 holiday bookings.
In 2019, finally, for the first time, everything was so stable. We had millions of tourists coming to Egypt. I mean, myself, I was busy the whole week. But after the coronavirus, everything just disappeared. We had to cancel flights, hotels, and that includes everyone works in the hotel. The company itself and people behind desk, we all lost our jobs. And then you have drivers, you have cars, and restaurants. All of these things are down.
The Tourism and Antiquities Minister Khalid Al-Anani is on a mission to bring back business and revive the economy, highlighting new hygiene and safety rules in media appearances at museums and airports. And in diving wear, inviting foreigners to fly in to some Red Sea resorts.
We lost around $1 billion per month, and we are estimating that we'll still lose a lot of money during the next coming weeks and months. For the time being, we will see the beaches, the desert, the water activities. Later on, we'll open the Nile Valley with Cairo, Alexandria, Luxor and Aswan.
Back near the Giza pyramids, there's construction work. COVID-19 delayed the opening of the new Grand Museum here that will house Tutankhamun's treasures. The hope is that it will become a big draw when it finally opens next year. Restoring tourism will take time, but Egypt can count on the enduring allure of its rich, pharaonic past.
That report from Yolande Nell. In France, celebrations have been taking place to mark the Bastille Day national holiday, but this year's events have changed because of coronavirus restrictions. For the first time since the end of World War II in 1945, officials called off the traditional military parade on the Champs-Élysées. Instead, troops honoured France's health workers in a scaled-down ceremony at the Place de la Concorde. The annual celebrations mark the storming of Bastille Prison on the 14th of July, 1789, widely seen as the start of the French Revolution. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield was following the events from Paris and told us more.
Well, as you say, it's been a very, very different 14 juillet celebration. It's been held at the Place de la Concorde, which is at the bottom of the Champs-Élysées, as you know. So there hasn't been the big parade with the armoured cars and the tanks and the horses and all the public lining the sides of the Champs-Élysées, which we would normally see. Instead, a much more restrained ceremony built around the oval of the Place de la Concorde. But I have to say, despite that, and the fact that it's been a much smaller scale affair, it was also very, very moving and very, very powerful. There was a military component. This is a military parade, a military day, and the armed forces were there. And there was a march past of the reviewing stands on foot by about 2,000 troops, men and women of various services. But then, and this is the most moving part of it all, came at the end, where the part of the ceremony which was directed at the civil helpers, the medical workers, the hospital staff who contributed to keep getting the country through the coronavirus, a tribute to them was carried out. And we saw representatives of that world, the world of the hospital staff and so on, coming out, standing side by side with members of the armed forces who had themselves, of course, contributed to the fight against COVID, the armed forces, medical service and so on, and together standing side by side in front of the presidential reviewing stand, unveiled this massive red, white and blue flag. It was very moving, and I'm sure people around the country will have been watching and said, well, we didn't have our full down the Champs-Élysées military parade like normal, but nonetheless, this was a fitting tribute and a very powerful tribute.
Hugh Schofield. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Celia Hatton. Until next time, goodbye.